Hello there, everybody. This is Richard Modiano. We're on Poet Runner. I'm here with my co-host and producer, Rafael Alvarado. And today we are going to be talking to Yehoshua November about his new book, Two Worlds Exist. And to start, I want to congratulate you on this really excellent collection. And, you know, tell us a little bit more about how this book came into existence.
Okay, thanks so much. It's a pleasure and an honor to be a guest on Poet Runner. This book, Two Worlds Exist, is largely, I would say, an autobiographical collection. There's many narrative poems in the book, and it chronicles, I guess, a time period in my life where I had younger children and the struggle to raise them and to be a good parent. And also the struggle to come to terms with my daughter's becoming deaf. So the poems in the book center around that event and other kind of tragic events that were occurring to my extended family, to my own family. So it was largely born out of responses to those kind of powerful family events. And the poetry was kind of a way to work through some of these events that really kind of shell-shocked myself and my family.
Well, I'd like you just to give a taste of this book to our listeners. Pick a poem that you think is a sort of pith summing up of that, something that would provide an entree into our conversation.
Okay, I mean, I could read the title poem of the book, Two Worlds Exist.
Please do that. No, that's good. Yeah, that would be fine.
It's a poem in three sections, so it's called Two Worlds Exist. Section one. If I wear an ice suit, I can fly beneath the sunset and not burn, my son said from the back of the van, as we drove over the bridge beneath the pink sky. And if I wear an ice suit, I thought, perhaps I will finish my days without roasting in the oven of what one human does to another, or the furnace of what God does to man. Once in Shul, I sat across from a rabbi who spoke of his suffering. He said, I don't have feet to stand on to complain. But I remember standing in a room 30 years ago, the Rebbe raising his voice to call God to task. A week earlier, at the ritual bath, the rabbi realized he had forgotten his white Sabbath shirt. In the sanctuary, I watched him stand up to pray the silent prayer in his undershirt and long black coat. What role do these moments of minor embarrassment play in a life of greater miseries? Could the rabbi concentrate on his prayers? And if so, what did he ask God for at that moment? Two, if I had worn a cage of ice around my heart, it would not have cracked as I stood in the cheder's narrow hallway and heard the principal's matter-of-fact voice say concerning one of my children, we cannot help her. If I wear a band of silence around my head, I will hear nothing. What my youngest daughter hears, I would like to rise up and lodge a complaint before God, but each morning I wake late for prayers and rush to catch up with the other worshipers. Once my wife turned to me and asked, do you think this happened because God wanted to show us what innocence looks like? Isn't she happier than the other? Then she turned her face back to her closet and cried into her blouses. Three, two worlds exist, the higher hidden one and our earthly realm. Everything that occurs in this life flows down from the hidden world. That which appears good descends through an infinite series of contractions until it fits within the finite vessels of this world. That which appears tragic slides down, unmitigated, from the hidden realm, a higher, unlimited good this world cannot hold. So the mystics explain suffering, if all comes from above, from where no evil descends. Is this something one tells another who is suffering? This is something one does not speak, but tries to believe when life no longer seems possible. When I was younger, I believed the mystical teachings could erase sorrow. The mystical teachings do not erase sorrow. They say, here is your life. What will you do with it?
That's a beautiful and very moving poem. And one thing that I noticed throughout the book, there are tragic situations that are addressed, and yet your voice is measured and even throughout. And I thought that was the best way of handling some of these subjects, because there is empathy, but there is a standing back from these events, and they are happening to you personally. They're not happening to someone outside. It's not something that we have read about in the newspapers that are responding to, where a certain measured distance becomes easy. But for the person who is experiencing them, I want to say it's close to an equanimity, but an acceptance. That's the better word, an acceptance of what is happening. And you were able to bring this out in your poetry without losing your balance, so to speak, was very impressive to me. And that must have been a challenge for you.
I think that what often happens is maybe I wrote some of the poems when I had some space from the original event that prompted the poem. I also think that I believe that sometimes an event or subject matter is poetic in and of itself, and it doesn't really require dramatization or embellishment. And sometimes I'm just trying to kind of get out of the way and let the story tell itself. I think that a lot of my poetry is not even that imaginative. It's pretty autobiographical, pretty narrative, but the subjects themselves lend themselves to poetry.
And, don't sell yourself short on this, because you have to select what you're going to put into that poem out of your own experience. You're going to have to sort of catalog the particulars that will bring that together in a poem, which is not the same as a short story or a novel. You have to put much more into a poem than you have the freedom to go on in a novel and develop a backstory and so forth. And the challenge of writing a poem is to get all of that emotion and all of that action and narrative into a limited number of words. And I think you do that very, very well. So,
thank you.
And it takes talent to know that. I mean, you're dealing with, you say you're dealing with your own life. Of course, you know your own life. But the challenge is to relate these things that a reader who knows you not at all, except by encountering you in a book, can relate to and can understand. So I think you do that very, very well.
Maybe one factor also that kind of counterbalances a strong or overt sense of emotion is the theological concepts that are incorporated in the poem as well, so that you kind of have two voices almost. You have the theology or the ideas that stem from faith or mysticism, and then you have the voice of my own experience. So that it's not solely one voice, the voice of personal experience. So that might also kind of counterbalance things.
Yeah, and that is apparent too. And by the way, for our listeners who are not familiar with Judaism or some of the words that come up in the poems, there is a glossary at the end. And I think that even a total secular reader who has no experience of religion whatsoever will be able to relate and resonate with these poems, because they're in a specific religious cultural framework, but at the same time the language is such and the presentation is such as not to drive anybody away or intimidate them, but rather to draw them in and make them want to know more. And, you know, that, and in the full disclosure, I also have a Jewish background, so, but it is of a slightly different tradition than Yahushua's. But nonetheless, I think anybody who has no religious interest at all will relate to these poems just on the simple level of their humanity. So don't
Thank
be intimidated. You. You will come up with it. Some specific words that are peculiar to the tradition will come up, but do not let that deter you. I really want to make this point to our readers, well, to our listeners rather, because we have a large listenership, and they're all different kinds of people. And I think it's really important to engage with poetry that comes from a different tradition, something outside your comfort zone, and to get into it and to open yourself to it, because it can enrich you. And these poems are not intimidating whatsoever. They invite you in. They share the experience with you. So, and I think, you know, you really succeeded at that for me. And Raphael, I mean, you're totally outside this tradition. What was your take on this?
Well, it's like I told them before, I enjoy reading the book because it's a culture I'm not part of, but it helps me understand the culture. That's why I like reading books of poetry from different cultures, because it gives me an understanding of their culture. I think you mentioned once that in a poem somewhere about being something about your tattoos, and then working your way back into being Orthodox.
Oh yeah, that's right. In my first collection, there's a poem about what's called Baal Tshuvas at the mikveh. A Baal Tshuva is a person who didn't grow up within the religious framework, or did originally and then left it, and then they come back. Mm-hmm. So there's a poem in my first collection, God's Optimism, about young men who have tattoos, which is not really part of the Jewish tradition, and they're at the ritual bath, and they've returned to a life of observing Judaism, but they have these tattoos still. So it's a kind of intersection of their previous life and their new kind of life of faith, and they have to kind of negotiate those two different worlds, right? Yeah, I think the book is, you know, although it's rooted in a particular cultural experience, a lot of it has to do with difficult experiences and heartbreaking experiences, difficulties raising families, which are really kind of universal themes, although,
yep,
you know, in this case, they're simply situated in a particular culture.
Well, to what you were saying earlier, there is a poem in this book that is apropos of that. It's a lesson from my father. Perhaps you could read that one for us.
Yeah, sure. Let me just find that one. Okay, the poem's called Lesson from My Father. I am just a person who, because of his Hasidic beard, appears to have great faith. Though I look like a rabbi, in my mind, I am always the least religious boy in the class, the son of a doctor in a class of rabbis' sons, who make this distinction clear. It is early in the morning, and I am crying in my bed before school. My father walks in after a night on call, sits down beside me, and says, "You are you because of you, not because of me."
Yeah, that's a great summation, a great summation.
Yep.
Yeah, I was fortunate, and I am fortunate, really, to have parents who were really supportive of me really taking whatever direction in life I wanted to take, supportive of me writing poetry, supportive of whatever kind of spiritual path I wanted to pursue. And I think that point's definitely embodied in this poem. What my father was telling me, even though I was a really young child, was that, you know, you're not really defined by me and what I do. You really have your own path in front of you, and it's up to you to define it and live it, which is really remarkable, I think, for a child to hear from a parent.
No, I can relate to that, because my father never liked most of my choices, but he supported them. You know, so So I can relate to that. That's definitely universal for, you know, a father and son, you know. You know,
yeah.
The support means a lot.
Right. A lot of us have a lot of trauma in therapy when it's otherwise.
Yeah, that's true. So one of the interesting things for me especially was to enter this particular culture, this Hasidic culture that I know from mainly scholarly books, and some relatives, I'm from a Sephardic background, and some relatives took an interest in Hasidism, and so I sort of know about it second and third hand. But somebody that is directly involved and is bringing it out in such fine poems in a way that I found enlightening and moving is really rare that you have an opportunity to. I mean, I'm speaking very personally at this point, but, you know, from my Sephardic background, we have our own traditions, our own music, poetry, language, idiomatic expressions, specific history, and so on. And to make this connection in a way that is purely human, that is like, you know, on a person-to-person level, it's like being in a conversation for me.
Yeah.
Even though this is the first time we have ever spoken, but the book was like that for me. And
yeah, I think that, you know, that's hopefully one of the accomplishments in the possibilities of art and especially poetry, to open a window into another culture and to let the person see, to the reader see how that life is actually lived. And I suppose that's why poetry and art is very powerful in terms of transcending otherness and seeing people as so different that we can't communicate with them. I think that's really one of the magical powers of art, to bridge people from different backgrounds by letting them see their shared humanity.
And for a poem that has no overt reference at all to religion, culture, and so forth, there is really a nice one called So Many Poems,
okay,
which is a personal poem. And I wonder if you would read that one for us.
Sure, one moment. So this is a poem for my wife, So Many Poems. So many poems about your dark hair, your dark body, storehouse of my private delights. At this moment, you drive the kids to school in the next town. It's almost summer. Classes at the university have let out. I return the fan to the attic window where the pine tree's upper branches sway. For breakfast, I've brought up an apple and a glass of water. Are you on the way home? Have you stopped off somewhere? So many poems with you as the centerpiece. And how infrequently I've imagined how you see our life together.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Yeah.
Thank you.
And on just the other page, there is Prayer, which is another poem that I like very much.
Okay, sure. I can read that. It's called Prayer. Before the silent prayer, some slip the hood of their prayer shawls over their heads so that even among many worshipers, they are alone with God. Primo Levi wrote about the sadness of a cart horse shut between two shafts and unable even to look sideways. Let me be like those pious ones or that horse so that even amidst the crowd, no other crosses the threshold of my dreaming.
So this is a poem that is really, it is, for me, it's like the description of what it is like to be praying, to actually, you are uttering a prayer to yourself and to God. Mm-hmm. And this prayer is like, you know, in I don't know how it is for other religious traditions, but I know that in the Jewish tradition, common to both main branches of Judaism, it is the direct communion with God. It is the way that you are addressing, and you're talking in your interior voice, sometimes articulating out loud, but you're making a connection with the divine. And this is done in a way that is unvarnished. It's direct. There's no path involved. That's what I like about it. Now thinking about it, it's the fact that it is done without any path or without any not necessarily pride, but I've done the right thing, or a pat on the back. Let's put it that way. It's very direct. It's done unvarnished and done off that.
Well, you know, so often I fail at prayer. So, you know, it's something you do all the time, three times a day in the tradition. So when it goes right, you're happy. Something that, you can't always get right. So it's not really a source of pride. It's more of a frustration. But you're definitely right about your description of prayer. In fact, in Hebrew, the word for prayer is called tefillah, and that is related to the word tofel, that's a clue, like one who solders a vessel. So when one is praying, one is trying to solder oneself to the divine, to connect to the divine.
And that leads me to another poem in the book from part three. I mean, it segues right into it very nicely, is "Live like the ark in the Holy of Holies."
Oh, sure, yeah. Okay, one sec.
Yeah.
Yeah, so this is a poem also in three sections, and it deals with an idea that's actually kind of front and center in Hasidic thinking, which is that a person lives in the natural, finite, limited world, and they go through the motions of life. You know, one has to earn a living and so forth. But at the same time, one is really also has a part of oneself that's kind of rises above it all and is transcendent of it all. So Hasidic thought often speaks about the kind of the combination of the finite and the infinite, or the natural and the supernatural. So in other words, in Hasidic thought, the ideal is not simply to transcend the world and escape it, but to kind of combine the world and the divine. So this poem speaks to that a little bit. It's called "Live Like the Ark in the Holy of Holies." One, live like the ark in the Holy of Holies, the Rebbe often said. 2.5 cubits long, 1.5 cubits wide, 1.5 cubits high, but paradoxically occupying no space in the room. So a man rises from his dark-haired wife in a rectangular bed, according to a precise clock, to earn paychecks in particular amounts, to pay for the life that unfolds within the boundary lines assigned to his name on a town map, filed in a metal municipal drawer. Instructed to believe his livelihood, whatever honor life affords him, comes from the one with no body and no form. 2. 1,000 years are to you like a passing yesterday or a single night watch, the psalmist wrote. You push through your mother into the fluorescence of the world, rush down your boyhood block for a haircut before your wedding, made love for the first and last time, beginning as a young couple, finishing with much older bodies in a distant city. 3. You hear the Torah read each week, 50 times a year over so many years. It is one long reading, and the young man reading grows old, standing his whole life at the bima. And the soul comes down because it needs something from the body.
Yeah, that's I mean, that's, it's like, it's like an it's almost like a cosmogony distilled into a three-section poem, and it's very comprehensive, very pithy, and it's the kind of poem that can be read again and again, as are all the poems in this book. But you know, you can the reader can the imaginative reader can transfer this poem to apply to their own life. Of I'm an old man. You are you're certainly a younger man than I am.
Relatively young man.
Relatively younger. And yet, for people who are younger than you, younger than me, younger than Raphael, you were like such a reader will be able to get sort of a glimpse of the possibilities of the life ahead. And, that is a strength that I found in all of these poems. The ability to reach out to so many people, and I think it's because you took a rhetorical position, rhetorical in the bad sense of the word, like I'm delivering an important message that I want you to receive, but rather coming to the reader with basically, here's what I have to offer. Perhaps it will be of use to you. Perhaps you will gain something from it. Now, there's a certain modesty to these poems, and at the same time, this modesty is an invitation. It certainly was to me. It's an invitation to contemplate the poems, turn them over in your mind and your heart, read them again. I even got some benefit from reading some of them out loud. So this is really a wonderful book. My phone, Raphael, you might have to wrap it up because my phone is dying. I had to switch phones beforehand.
All right.
The phone wasn't working, but
that's fine.
The book is Two Worlds Exist by Yehoshua November. That's just regular November. Publisher is Horizon Press. Horizon Books, and I believe you can probably order the book from their website.
Yes.
Possibly from your independent bookseller. Where else can we get the book?
You could get it on Amazon. I think maybe Barnes & Noble. But the best place is probably from the publisher's website, Horizon Books.
Good. Well, we always want, and we recommend that most often on this show, we recommend that you go to the publisher because small presses really do need your support. And buying it directly from them helps them out immeasurably. So it's been a pleasure talking to you. I enjoyed this conversation and I love the book. So I'm going to have it.
Thank you so much.
Before my phone.
Yep. Do you have any events coming up that you want to mention?
I'm going to be doing some events. I'm going to be doing an online event on August 21st with a forum called Verse Virtual. So that will be online. Could you check out my website, yeshuanovember.com, or my Facebook page, Poetry by Yeshua November, and I keep that updated with events that are coming up, reading.
Oh, after we sign off, email me the website, because on my Facebook Poet Runner group, I like to promote anybody who's been on the show and promote whatever they
sure.
do.
Sure, thank you. Thank you very much.
Yeah, no, it was great hearing you read, because I actually told everybody that you were coming on the show that, you know, how much your poetry has meant to me since I first discovered it. It's, poetry to me, it has to really grab you, and your poetry grabs me. It has always brought my attention. And, I mean, I don't call myself a fan of much poetry, but I'm definitely a fan of yours.
I really appreciate that, Raphael. Thank you. Thanks for all you do to support poetry.
Oh, yeah. I love poetry. And, I mean, that's – plus, you know, I always love reading your work. And when I saw you read at the LA Times Book Festival, that, you know, it struck me as, like, I could learn something here that I wouldn't learn with, you know, that I wouldn't know. So that's something else that your poetry has given me. It's given me a knowledge of a different culture.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
And this has been Raphael Alvarado for Poet Runner, and Yehoshua November has been here with us, and it's been great having him. And please support, buy his book, support his upcoming book, and thank you for listening.
Thanks so much.